Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, December 9th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome Albany County Health Commissioner Dr. Elizabeth Whalen to answer your questions about the COVID-19 pandemic. It appears what the experts predicted, a second wave, is here. And we will talk to Dr. Whalen about that, what the county is doing, what you can do. If you have a question, we'll get to as many as we can. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Liable to be a very busy show, so get your question in early. And we'll be back with Dr. Elizabeth Whalen right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing COVID-19 today with Dr. Elizabeth Whalen. Dr. Whalen is the commissioner of the Albany County Department of Health. She has worked on initiatives involving communicable disease control, public health preparedness, and environmental health. And if you have a question, this will be a popular program. I advise you to call now. There are a few lines open, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us, and that's no guarantee your question will get through, but we'll do the best we can on all. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Whalen, we last spoke about a month ago. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Ray. Hope you're doing well.
I am doing well, and I hope you are doing well. And I just want to thank you. You are a pillar of strength. We watch you just about every day, and your information is clear and concise, and it's pretty terrifying, but in the way you deliver it, you do it in a very reassuring way. So we feel pretty good having you here, and especially on this program. The news, however, is not too good. 186 new positive cases in Albany County since yesterday, 16 new hospitalizations. A couple of days ago, you said, look, we have not seen the worst of the post-Thanksgiving holiday blowback yet. When do you think that peak will be, and what will it look like?
Yeah, so, you know, generally, when we look historically at how we've seen COVID spread and how other events like holidays or gatherings seem to influence number of cases, we generally see the biggest uptick in cases about 2 weeks after an event. So, you know, it will be soon that we are seeing the effects of Thanksgiving in terms of number of cases. Unfortunately, what comes after the uptick in cases is the uptick in hospitalizations. And then what comes after the hospitalizations is, unfortunately, sometimes we start to see an uptick in deaths. So this is why, you know, we really try to be as proactive with our public health messaging as possible in sharing with people that what they do today really influences what's going to happen in the coming weeks and months. So that is what we're anticipating. The numbers will continue to increase until we're about at that 2 weeks. And, you know, we're also concerned because we're in the holiday season and knowing that, you know, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, people usually are on the move. Lots of people are used to having holiday gatherings, whether they're for work or other social events. And we're really asking people so that we don't have a surge upon a surge to make an exception to those kind of activities this year. It's not fun, but it's necessary.
Dr. Fauci, of course, mentioned and has mentioned several times over the last week or two that the Thanksgiving peak will coincide with the Hanukkah and Christmas peak and into the new year, things could be tough. Now, hospitalizations are interesting. We saw 16 new overnight, and there are 94 county residents, according to the press release the county put out earlier today. I wonder if you can tell me, without violating any HIPAA, the youngest and oldest in that 94.
So I don't have that breakdown for today, but I can tell you that, you know, the hospitalizations that we have seen in the past couple of weeks have been a multitude of age ranges. We have seen people in as young as their 20s hospitalized. Of course, we know that there's a disproportionate share of severity of illness and ICU stays in those that are older and have pre-existing conditions. So that is pretty much following what we would expect to see. But I don't want people to be reassured that because they're a certain age, or even if they don't have health problems, that COVID is not something that could result in them being hospitalized. Unfortunately, we can't give that reassurance.
And, you know, it's if you watch football, I saw the game last night, and the quarterback for the Ravens, he just got back from COVID protocols, and he had symptoms, and he said, this is not a joke. I'm paraphrasing, but it was not fun. And this is a guy who's a picture of health. So I think there's a lesson for all of us there. Before we get to the calls, and I do want to get to as many as we can, let's just talk about vaccines for a minute. We heard it in Jim Lavoulis' newscast. New York State is setting up cold storage sites around the state to hold on to this vaccine that's coming in. I forget the number he said that Albany County will be getting. But we know from what Governor Cuomo said on these airwaves yesterday, the military, the U.S. military, will have a great deal to do with the distribution of the vaccines. And the state is involved with the storage of the vaccines. What is the county going to be doing as the vaccine is rolled out?
Right. So that's a good question. So, you know, I just emerged about 15 minutes ago from a call with our state health department, which involved all the local health departments across the state. And there was information that was provided on that call about the vaccine, and that there will be there has been establishment of regional hubs that will be in different regions of the state, including the capital region, who will be in receipt of the initial vaccine supply. Likely, the hospitals will be getting the first supply as well as nursing homes. Now, from a county health department perspective, we have already submitted a vaccine plan to the New York State Department of Health. We will likely be come more into play when we get to the stage of the vaccine being provided to members of the public. And this may involve activities we've done in the past, which include large-scale point of dispensing. We did that in 2009 with H1N1. We have conducted flu clinics from time to time, and we drill on this, at least a few times a year. But we'll be involved with our healthcare partners, our community-based organizations, and our local government agencies on that planning. As to what it will look like in granular detail, we are prepared to staff and man vaccine clinics, but I don't know yet whether that is what's going to occur. So we're prepared, and we're looking at a rollout of vaccine. As I'm sure everybody's aware, it will initially go to nursing homes and high-risk elderly populations. That's done through the federal government, and they have done contracts with CVS and Walgreens, who will be going into those facilities and vaccinating individuals. The hospitals will also be, charged with preparing how their staff will be vaccinated. So we have our preparation, and we are waiting for our marching orders, and we're waiting to see what the more granular plans will be when the vaccine starts to roll out to the public, which will probably take a little bit longer time.
Dr. Elizabeth Whalen, Commissioner of the Albany County Department of Health, joins us today. One more question, and then we'll take a fast break and hit the phones and the email bag. You mentioned, again, hospitalizations. At what point, or maybe let me rephrase, how close are we to reaching critical mass, saturation in our hospitals here in the greater Albany area?
So I think right now hospital capacity is pretty good. Obviously, this is something that's being looked at, regionally and by the state under a microscope. And it's a very dynamic process. Right now, we have capacity in our hospitals and within our ICUs to take an additional volume of patients. But, there's many unknowns. We don't know how fast our growth in cases is going to occur and how fast, we may see progression of illness to the point of people needing hospitalization. And always at this time of year, we're very mindful that we're also coming into flu season, which may adversely affect surge capacity in hospitals. So, you know, it's always going to be part of my message for people to get out and get that flu shot during flu season to take some of the burden off of our hospitals and so that you don't, in fact, yourself or your family get sick with influenza.
Until the vaccine gets here, our healthcare providers will have to be doubly wary as the surge hits again. Have you any sense of how the local nurses and the doctors and the hospital workers are doing? Has everybody stayed healthy for the most part?
Well, you know, I think that healthcare workers are a microcosm of the community. So, of course, there are healthcare workers that have been affected by COVID, and particularly, you know, those that are working with patients who, you know, utilize the state-of-the-art personal protective equipment, nothing is 100%. So, you know, we have seen some cases among healthcare workers in the county, which is not unusual, and it's happening across the country. And, you know, we've also started to see the very beginnings of, you know, people talking about stress and fatigue around what could be coming. So there's understandably, you know, a certain amount of concern and, you know, wondering what the future holds.
Dr. Elizabeth Whalen joins us on Vox Pop today. Your call's coming up. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you, joined today by Dr. Elizabeth Whalen, Commissioner of the Albany County Department of Health. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Whalen, let's do a couple of quick emails here, and then we'll jump to the phones. This one is from Stacy, and Stacy says, my children's school is asking close contacts of those who test positive for COVID to quarantine and not come to school, but not the siblings of those who are considered close contacts. This seems concerning to me. Is there science behind this decision that I am not understanding? And that's a great question from Stacy.
Stacy, that's a great question, and it's one we get daily at the health department. And what it boils down to is this. If you are a contact to a case, you've been identified as someone that may be in close proximity to the case, and so you are placed on quarantine. But if you are a contact of a contact, you are not placed on quarantine. So in this situation, parents, let's say, for example, they have a child in third grade and a child in their classroom was diagnosed with COVID. We have, because we know that's approximate risk, it's not a really close contact, but because they're in an enclosed environment and because the school is a sensitive setting, we do recommend quarantine for that entire class of third graders. But if that third grade child has a sibling that's in fifth grade, that child is not recommended to be quarantined because that child was not exposed. So the answer is that you're watching the child that you have under quarantine, who, by the way, should be separated from your other children while they are on home quarantine, according to the guidance, to see if that child develops any symptoms. If the child is asymptomatic, you may choose to test that child with a rapid test if they are asymptomatic and with a PCR laboratory-based test if they become positive, usually around day 7. And then it can give you a pretty good idea, you know, of a risk of that child coming down with illness. But, you know, we don't recommend contacts of contacts to be quarantined. So that's why that decision is made.
This one's from Frank. Frank says, my wife and I are debating visiting two family members that tested positive for COVID during the spring and continue to have no symptoms. Our daughter has continued to test negative after her 14-day quarantine in mid-October. What would our risk be if we visit them or we have our daughter visit and stay for several days? And that's from Frank.
So, you know, I mean, I think this gets to the heart of the advice that we're giving people now, that it's a very difficult thing to tell people that they should avoid small family gatherings. But it really appears that the spread that we're seeing in the community and across the country, one of the pinpoint risk factors is through small gatherings. And that's because people are letting their guard down, they're taking masks off in the house, and they may be sharing food, et cetera, the things we like to do around the holidays. Knowing that your relatives had previously been positive offers some degree of protection, but the unfortunate thing is, at this point, we don't know how much. So I cannot provide a guarantee that they have immunity and that they have not themselves been exposed recently. Similarly, with a child, and I don't know if your child is someone that's living with you or not living with you. I kind of took it as maybe she's coming home from college or from somewhere else to visit. It's good that she's tested negative. But again, if you go to our website, you can see that testing is a difficult on its own without a quarantine is not a way you can completely guarantee safety. So if someone tests on a Saturday and they are negative, but they were exposed a couple of days before that, they wouldn't be expected to test positive. It takes about 4 to 7 days to become positive. So you have to have a combination of quarantine and testing to reassure family members. And I have two college kids myself. So this is the strategy that we're looking at before you can come home and join that family unit with a degree of comfort.
This last email, well, there are several more, but we'll only do one more now, and then we will jump to the phones. This one is from Lou in Altamont, and it's in all caps, so I think he means it. This is, okay, does a person having the comorbidities identified as dangerous for COVID-19 have a higher risk of acquiring the virus or a greater chance of death or other issues from having it? And that's actually a good question. That's from Lou in Altamont.
Well, Lou, those are great questions. So in terms of your risk for contracting the disease, if you are in any way, shape, or form immune suppressed and you're exposed to COVID, there is a slightly increased risk of you breaking down in disease than someone who might have a healthier immune system. But the bigger problem is around comorbidities that could lead to complications or could predispose you to complications. So we do know that there are people that have those comorbidities that get mild cases of COVID, but that's not always the case. And you are at a higher risk if, for example, you have heart disease or diabetes or asthma or obesity or if you're a smoker. These are some of the things that can place you at higher risk to get more severe disease. And when you get into that more severe disease category, there is a risk for hospitalization. And any time that, you know, that you're ill enough to go into the hospital, if you need to go to intensive care, there's always a risk associated with that of death. So this is, you know, we try to inform the public best as possible to be informed by the risk factors. But even if you're a healthy individual, to still practice good public health behaviors.
Dr. Elizabeth Whalen, the commissioner of the Albany County Department of Health, joins us. And now to the phones we go, 800-348-2551. Rob in Livingston. Rob, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I'm a physician in my office is in Kingston, New York. And my question for Dr. Whalen is, what is the thinking or planning or such about distribution of vaccination to community physicians and their staff? After all, we're not necessarily exposed to active cases of COVID, but we are taking care of everyone else and also seeing lots of folks. So I'd like to hear what you know about that, okay, if anything.
Well, that's a great question, Rob, and thank you for the work that I'm sure you're doing in your community. You know, the prioritization for healthcare workers will start with hospital workers who are frontline workers. But then, of course, we're going to be looking to vaccinate our community providers because the docs that we have working in the community are frontline as well. And many docs, particularly those that are in primary care, are seeing patients with COVID on a daily basis. So it's very important that a vaccine strategy include them as well, include you as well. So, you know, that strategy looks to provide a vaccine to healthcare workers as we get it. So right now we have a tiered system because of limited supply. So the first tier will likely go to the hospital, frontline hospital workers, and they might even need to drill down within hospitals dependent on supply. But we're looking at getting increasing supplies for healthcare workers in shorter terms. So, for example, we might get a first shipment and then get a second shipment or six days later. So we really are looking at vaccinating healthcare providers, EMS workers, et cetera, on the earlier phases of the vaccine deployment.
Rob, thank you very much. You know, you speak of the vaccine. The one that we are getting in this country first, I believe, is the one that requires two doses, right?
Well, it's likely that all the vaccines will require two doses. And the reason for that is that this is a novel disease and people don't have any pre-existing immunity to it. But the first vaccine supply we'll likely be seeing is Pfizer. And the reason that Pfizer is a little bit different than the others, like Moderna, is that it does require very specific conditions for storage, which is deep freeze storage. So the capacity has been built around the state for these regional hubs to be able to have the ability to store that vaccine and deploy from there.
What is the duration between dose one and dose two? Do we know?
I think it's 28 days. I know it's somewhere between 21 and 30 days. It's usually, you know, that time period to get the second vaccine.
Now, obviously, I would imagine that the science is still out to some extent on this, but will there be any efficacy from dose one? In other words, healthcare worker A gets dose one. Will he or she be less likely to get COVID even before dose two?
Sure. So, you know, I mean, there is definitely going to be some benefit from the first vaccine, but we will obviously ask people to continue to utilize the same protective measures that they're utilizing until after they get their second vaccine. And sometimes after the second vaccine, it takes a couple of weeks after that time to see the full potency of immunity in the 95 percentile that we're hearing about from the clinical trial. And this is the same, again, that I'll say for the flu vaccine. If you get a flu vaccine, it takes 2 weeks after you get the flu vaccine to develop immunity. So people should be aware of that, too, and realize it's a good reason not to delay your flu shot.
Good advice. Dr. Elizabeth Whalen joins us. And now let's go to Lou in Burnt Hills. Lou, you're on.
Hi. Thank you very much. I do appreciate the opportunity to ask a question. Can you hear me okay?
Go ahead.
Yes, Lou, thanks.
My question, Dr. Whalen, first it's a comment. It seems pretty obvious to me that there are a great number of people who are quite apprehensive about getting the vaccine, and there are going to be some people that just will not get the vaccine at all. So when considering that and the possibility for distribution delays, it raises, you know, a concern. My main concern being not knowing how long the effectiveness of the vaccine will be for people that do get it. Could this be a situation where people will just keep on reinfecting each other and the COVID situation can go on indefinitely? Or do we have any kind of statistics now as to how long, you know, the vaccine does remain effective?
So these are great questions too, Lou, and I'm thankful for you asking them. In terms of, and there were a bunch of, I think, issues that you covered. The first, I suppose, would be vaccine hesitancy, which I think is something that we're all aware of. And really, for us to be able to get what, you know, we're looking at for herd immunity, for COVID to go away, we need, you know, between 70 and 90% of people to either be vaccinated or immune. And that is going to be a tough challenge. There's going to need to be a lot of public messaging. Hopefully, with the tier strategy, we will be able to see public figures that can help influence people about the safety of it. You know, those of us in the medical profession that have reviewed the safety and efficacy data have that reassurance, and there'll be a lot of public information going out on this. But it's a big ask to get that many people vaccinated. And until we get into that ballpark, we run the risk of COVID continuing to spread. In terms of how long the efficacy of the vaccine lasts, does it need to be a yearly shot? Will it need to be administered only once? That we are still waiting definitive evidence on. And I think, you know, what has been done with everybody that has received the vaccine in trials is that they're monitoring and following their antibody response. And so they're all 6 months ahead of the rest of us, perhaps a year ahead of many of us who will get the vaccine. So that information will be evolving, you know, as many of us get our first vaccine, and will help inform what happens next season. So we'll be looking to that data. You know, what I keep hearkening back to is that, you know, this is a novel virus. And so it doesn't necessarily follow all the playbooks of other viruses. It is not the same as influenza, which in some ways can be helpful from a vaccine perspective, because it doesn't look like it mutates as much as flu does, which is why we need a yearly flu shot. But we don't have the complete answers on how long immunity will last. And we'll look to the studies to show us that data as time goes forward.
Lou, thank you very much for a great call. One more here before the next break. Clark in Woodstock. Clark, you're on.
Yeah, thank you for having me on here. I've been trying to find the answer to this question. So let's say you're fully vaccinated with the two shots and 2 weeks have gone by. Can you still infect a family member with COVID?
So if you are, if you've received both shots, then you are 95% protected. So unfortunately in medicine, we can really never say never. So there is still a very small chance along the order of 5% that you could become infected and infect another person. So that's why it's, you know, when we talk about one person getting a shot, it's not helpful for the rest of the community. But when we talk about masses of people, that are taking the shot together and most people having immunity, that's when we really talk about COVID moving out. So it is going to take time for all of us to get into that that position, which is why I think we're hearing a lot of messages that going into the new year, even into the summer, it is likely that we are still going to have to mask and social distance until we really get to that point where we are seeing the cases drop off and become almost non-existent.
Clark, thanks for the call. Our number here on Vox Pop is 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Elizabeth Whalen, Commissioner of the Albany County Department of Health. One email here, and then maybe a couple of more after the break. This one's from Judy. And Judy in Newburgh writes, if two people are wearing masks, is it relatively safe to hug if you're outdoors? I live alone, and I really miss a good hug. That's from Judy.
Judy, I'm sure you're not alone in missing a really good hug. It's very difficult. The unfortunate truth is that, you know, masks do offer protection, but they don't offer absolute protection. So while you're looking to do this in the best possible way, being outside where the airflow is good and wearing masks, I still cannot tell you that it is a completely devoid of risk thing to do. Limiting contact to very short periods of time is helpful, but you know, when you hug, the unfortunate truth is that your respiratory secretions are very near the person you're next to, and unless you're, you know, wearing a completely sealed mask, when most of us are wearing face coverings and surgical masks, there still is a risk, unfortunately.
Dr. Elizabeth Whalen joins us. Tell you what, doctor, we'll take a quick break, and then we will hit the home stretch on this program. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Dr. Elizabeth Whalen joins us today, and a busy person she is. Thank you so much for being with us for this 1 hour. Do you do a press conference 7 days a week, right? Even on Thanksgiving, I think we saw you.
Not every single day, but pretty near. Yeah. Not every single day.
Well, yeah. Well, someday this will end, and you can take a week off, maybe. This is from Joe in New Paltz.
I look forward to that.
Joe writes, someone I know owns a daycare business. A young child, 2 years old, tested positive for COVID. So did her parents. After initial quarantine, the parents were desperate for her to come back, but she still tested positive. The family pediatrician approved her to come back, saying that there could be a positive result even 30 days later and that there would be no danger if she returned. The daycare owner was in a dilemma. The pediatrician's opinion sounded preposterous to me. What do you think, Dr. Whalen? And that's from Joe in New Paltz.
Great question, Joe. So, you know, the bottom line is you can continue to test positive with a PCR test after you are contagious. So, you know, the guidelines and what the science has shown us is that most of the time, virtually always, people are not contagious beyond 10 days of illness. Now, there are sometimes exceptions to that. So people that are very ill or that are hospitalized can continue to shed virus a little bit longer. But the PCR test can sometimes pick up evidence of the bacteria that is not able to be replicated. So we have seen, and it's a very common occurrence, for people to test positive after they are past their illness. And, you know, what local health departments do, and I'm sure that your local health department would weigh in on this too, is make decisions in high-risk situations or sensitive situations, and daycares would certainly be one of those, to release a child from isolation and allow them to go back. This situation is not at all unusual, and it is one of the reasons that we don't mandate that people test negative. That's not really a test of cure. It really is knowing that the scientific studies have not shown that most people shed virus after 9 or 10 days. And so that is the period that we isolate people at home for. And then they're usually pretty safe to go back to work. Now, again, I can't say no risk because that's just not a term that I would ever use. But with the evidence that we're provided, that's the guidance that we've been providing to all of our school kids, everybody going back to work, everybody going back, and we have not seen evidence of transmission with utilizing that guidance.
We're joined today by Dr. Elizabeth Whalen and Joan in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Hang in there. You'll be next. I just wanted to ask you, Dr. Whalen, about contact tracing just a little bit. Are your tracers overtaxed at the moment? And I'll tell you why I ask after you answer.
Yes. The answer to that is yes, and they have been. You know, it's been a very dynamic situation. Obviously, we have we have case investigators for other communicable diseases that have worked with the department for years. But for us, you know, when you look at the usual communicable diseases that we get, we may get a pertussis once in a while, once in a great while. We get a small outbreak of mumps. If there was a measles case, one single measles case would pretty much stop the department for a day and a half. So now we're getting hundreds of cases every day that need individual phone calls and follow-up and guidance and education. And then we need to get their list of contacts and start contacting those individuals. So it's beyond a level of work that any local health department has seen, and our local health department certainly is no exception. So we are working 7 days a week, which is also we had people on call 7 days a week, but we didn't all show up to the office every day, 7 days a week, and work, you know, 10-hour days, 7 days a week. And that's pretty much what's happening now. We have had to utilize our Medical Reserve Corps. We have had to bring in additional staff from our other county agencies and train people. And it's really been a very Herculean effort. So I think that we're not alone in Albany County. I think most other health departments feel the same way.
I mean, here's one of the problems when schools are open. And I'll give you an example from a family that I know nearby who one of their kids was in high school. The school quarantined a couple of classes, and it was at least a week or 8 or 9 days until after the quarantine technically should have begun when the contact tracers finally got in touch with these people. And it turned out that person was not in the school, was out on the day of contact. And they said, okay, well, your quarantine will end in 2 days. And so my question for you is there any mechanism to increase the number of contact tracers?
Oh, yes, we've definitely increased the number of contact tracers. But, you know, it takes time for the staff to train contact tracers. And it's not really just anybody that can become a contact tracer. So the race that we run is trying to increase our staffing capacity at the same time of being in an arena that we don't really know how fast the cases are going to increase.
Yeah.
And when we have what's happened in the past few weeks, which is an exponential increase in cases, sometimes that means it takes us a few days to try to do that catch-up period of ensuring that we have the adequate workforce.
Dr. Elizabeth Whalen joins us, and Joan in Glastonbury has been waiting about a half an hour. Joan, you're on.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to preface what I say with the idea that I'm 100% in favor of masks, but I've been reading some scientific studies. I think they were published in the British Medical Journal. One was regarding particulates. They studied particulates from commercial masks and cloth masks and found a considerable number of those, and were outlining the dangers, fibrosis, and other lung disorders, as well as increased breathing rate. And the second study that I read, also from the same source, I think, dealt with the bacterial accumulation on the inside of the masks, and that was dangerous too. So I just was interested in the doctor's response. I'm sure that she has had contact with those ideas, and I wanted the input from an expert on this.
Dr. Whalen.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for your patience and waiting to get your question in. So in terms of masks, what we know is that, you know, masks can lessen disease transmission. And in lessening disease transmission, they lessen hospitalizations and they lessen death. The type of mask that you are wearing is important. So a hospital grade mask, like a surgical mask, is something that I would recommend. But we also have been told that people can wear cloth masks because they do filter out large droplets and you know, so many of the particles that can result in infection. Now, I don't think for the period of time that we're talking about people being among others wearing masks, there are risks with these type of masks for people in terms of inhaling particles from the masks. So I don't think that given the relative concern around getting COVID, and if you look at a risk-benefit analysis, it is overwhelmingly in the favor of wearing masks to protect yourself from COVID. In terms of looking at bacteria, this is important because, you know, it speaks to the importance of keeping a mask clean or not to reuse masks unless they are cleaned in a very specific manner. So this is something that, you know, I think is important information to give to the public that, you know, if you are wearing a cloth mask, it's a good idea to wash it daily. If you're wearing surgical masks, those are disposable and shouldn't really be worn for more than one use. Because they won't offer the best protection for you. But in terms of people coming down with bacterial illnesses from mask wearing and bacteria under the mask, I think probably the biggest risk may be, you know, maybe getting a pimple on your face. But other than that, we're not seeing any bacterial problems, infections, systemic infections from masks at all.
Joan, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Elizabeth Whalen joins us here on Vox Pop. And let's go over to Spencertown. And Maureen, you're on.
Yes, can you hear me?
You bet. Go ahead.
Okay. I was on speakerphone, sorry. So my question, I realized, doctor, that you're not a medical doctor, but...
I am a medical doctor.
Yeah. Hold the phone. She sure
you
is.
Are. I'm sorry.
Yes.
I apologize.
I'm not a medical doctor, but that's okay.
I know you're
yes.
not. I'm so sorry. Yes. I don't know.
But, it's no
so
problem.
My question is, I have read about the incidence of urticaria or hives as being a presentation of COVID, and I just wondered if you had seen that at all, if you have any experience with that.
Well, I will tell you, even though I'm a medical doctor and I'm formerly an internist in clinical practice, I have not been in clinical practice now, and I have not seen the manifestation of urticaria or hives as a presentation for COVID. But what I will say is that we have seen many, many unusual presentations for COVID, and there has been, particularly in pediatric patients, a presentation with rash that I'm aware of. So, you know, while it's not common, we do encourage people that may be concerned that they have a risk or that they're feeling unwell in many ways, shapes, or form because COVID does present with such protein manifestations to get a test. to put your mind at ease. And if it's associated with symptoms, you would want to make sure that that test was a lab-based PCR test, just to rule that out.
Versus like an instant test or...
Yeah, instant tests we generally recommend for people that are concerned they may have been exposure. The problem with the rapid test is that sometimes you can miss positive cases. So really the gold standard of testing is that PCR test, which doesn't have to be nasopharyngeal, but a lot of them now that are just, you know, put into the nose. And the important piece is that you know it gets sent out to the lab, which means you don't get an immediate result. You might get a day or two later to have results.
Maureen, thank you very much. To Warwick, New York. And Nancy, Warwick, you're on.
Hi. My question was regarding the impact of COVID on pregnant women. Our daughter is expecting our first child, and her partner has just tested positive for COVID. So, of course, we're all panic-stricken and worried, and I wondered if you had much information on how it's impacting pregnant women.
Well, that's a good question, and you know, I wish the best of health for your daughter. It's certainly an exciting time, but also a frightening time for so many women who are experiencing pregnancy during this time. You know, we are not seeing pregnancy is always something that we have special attention to and want to monitor very carefully for presence of infection. But we're not seeing very high rates of comorbidity due to pregnancy with COVID, which is a good thing. So I imagine if her husband is positive, that they have separated in terms of the space that they're living in for the time that he's on isolation. The other good news is that, you know, household contacts are not always a guarantee that they're going to develop COVID. You know, you'd be surprised, but a lot of times we see positives in about 50% of household contacts or 60% of household contacts. So hopefully it's the case that she won't go on to develop disease. And if she's young and otherwise healthy, she could have a very mild form. But in that circumstance, I certainly would advise her to follow public health advice and be separate from him you know, so he can have his own bathroom and own bedroom and not share any living space for the time that he's ill. That would be helpful. And she might want to consider testing around day 7 after her last exposure to him, just to give her some reassurance.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks, Nancy. Oh,
you're welcome.
And congratulations. Over to Saul. Call Saul in Niskayuna. Saul, you're up.
Thanks. Let's see. In late February, I got really, really sick, wound up in the hospital. They referred me to a heart doctor who said I have that, what is it called? Right bundle block in my heart.
Right bundle
bridge
block, yes.
That's it. And AFib. And I also have CLL. So my question, I've heard that people with CLL get quite a bit sicker with this disease coming in with the virus. And I'm wondering if this is something I should contact my oncologist about and at some point schedule a shot somehow. I don't know if they'll be giving them at doctor's offices or wherever. But so my basic question is, does CLL make this new virus a more dangerous enemy?
Well, that's a good question. And certainly, you know, with CLL, you would be considered someone that was, you know, immune compromised. And so it would certainly place you at higher risk and would likely, you know, move you up in a little risk categorization when it comes time for the general public to be vaccinated. I do think that, you know, it would be a good idea to be vaccinated. And particularly for someone like you, you want to make sure that you're doing the best that you can to protect yourself from exposure to other individuals. And unfortunately, right now, where we are in New York State with a positivity rate of about 5-point-something, you know, people that are out and about kind of have to presume almost that they're being exposed and really act accordingly with wearing masks. If you don't need to go out and about and can get others to do errands, et cetera, for you, it probably would be advisable. But yes, I think it's important for, you know, patients with hematologic problems to certainly be in contact contact with their oncologists or hematologists about, you know, the advisability of the vaccine. Your doctor would, knowing your history, would be able to probably give you more specific advice for you than I could. But I would say, as a generalization, you would be you'd be a good candidate for the vaccine.
Saul, thank you very much. Let's grab one more call here, and then we'll hit two fast emails, and then you'll be done for the day here with us anyway. David in Saratoga. David, you're on. Hello, David. Oh, goodbye, David. All right, we'll go right to the email. This one is from, I'm not sure who it's from. The subject heading is interesting, though. Long haul COVID. Could you speak to the research and plans of care being done for people who are experiencing 6 to 10 months of long haul COVID symptoms?
Yeah, this is really emerging and interesting and frightening as well, in that we are seeing a subset of patients who go on to have what this person is referring to as long haul COVID. So they're prolonged symptoms that go on, but beyond the time that they are infectious, beyond the time that they're acutely ill, and they can be many different types of complaints and symptoms, from very general things like excessive fatigue to ongoing headaches to cardiac problems like congestive heart failure can sometimes occur. These are all things that are being very actively looked at and monitored, and we're really learning right now. Right now, for most of these patients, the management would be consistent with the management for what that type of illness normally would be. So if it's a cardiac complaint, you would treat it like you would, usually treat congestive cardiac failure, but just follow a little bit more closely along. And it's very important that, you know, we know about these patients so that, we can continue to get data and best inform how we're managing them, because the management right now is supportive. So treating the symptoms that people have. But as time goes on, we may learn more about that. But it's a very interesting area of study and an interesting area of medical literature that I'm interested to follow. And right now, we don't know an awful lot about it. So we advise people to follow up with their general practitioners if it is a particular manifestation like a neurologic or a cardiologic. You would follow up with those particular subspecialty providers, and then, you know, as we know more, hopefully we'll be able to give more clear, specific plans of care for those individuals.
Well, Dr. Elizabeth Whalen, I cannot thank you enough for being here, for carving an hour out of your very busy day, and we really appreciate it. I hope you stay healthy. Everybody who works with you maybe can take a nap once in a while. And hang in there, Doc. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Ray. It's been great to chat with you, and I hope you stay healthy, too. Take care, everybody.
Bye. Support comes from Mother Earth Storehouse, open 7 days, working to help keep our communities safe and supplied with EDC goods and services, serving the Hudson Valley with organic and all-natural foods since 1978, MotherEarthStorehouse.com. And Hudson River Housing, encouraging listeners to share with those in need during the season of giving. Housing with compassion, development with vision, HudsonRiverHousing.org. Once again, a big thanks to Dr. Elizabeth Whalen for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Terrific calls today. Apologies if we did not get to yours. Great emails as well. And again, we all could only do what we can do here in 1 hour, but I think everybody did a great job with the questions. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. Thanks to Matthew Plummer for answering the phones. Tomorrow on the big program, it's the Science Farm. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. right here on Vox Pop. Stand by now for 51%.